The mindfulness practice we teach, in which we practice here at Spirit Rock, has its origins in the teachings of the Buddha. And the Buddha taught this practice for the purpose of freedom, of liberation. Another synonym for liberation, the word liberation, is release. He taught this practice for the purposes of release, to be released. And sometimes people will confuse relief with release. And relief is nice, but relief doesn't last. And the Buddha was pointing to something more radical than relief and comforting, but to a fundamental change in the psyche that can be characterized as release or freedom. So he spent many years teaching about freedom. And in the course of doing that, he taught many, many different ways, including composing poetry. And there's a book of anthology of his teachings that was collected, you know, a long, long time ago, that's called the Udana. And it's translated into English as the Inspired Utterances, the Inspired Sayings. And it's primarily a place that holds these poems that the Buddha supposedly spontaneously uttered when he was inspired. And I would like to read one of them that has to do with freedom. And the poem appears at the end of a story, or an event. There's an event that happened that he was participating, that he was part of. It ended in the man becoming awakened, becoming liberated. And after this man's awakening, the Buddha was inspired, and he made up this poem. So I'll first tell you the poem, and then I'll tell you the story. And it's a story which is very dear to Vipassana movement, because it's the story of Bahiya. And there's a part of that story of Bahiya which is often quoted here at Spirit Rock as pointing to some kind of essence or the heart or something very pure, simple about how mindfulness practice can be done, how it can be liberating. The story of Bahiya, it's the story of the person who was enlightened the fastest in the time of the Buddha. So in the Zen school, they talk about sudden awakening. So this is pretty sudden, the story. So it's kind of a nice story. So the poem, might seem a little strange, but if maybe as you listen to it, it maybe it opens you a little bit to the possibility of something different than what's commonplace, what you commonly, the world as you commonly know it or understand it. Where water, earth, fire, and wind have no footing, there the stars do not shine, the sun is not visible, the moon does not appear, darkness is not found. And when a sage, through wisdom, has known this for him or herself, then from form and formless, from bliss and pain, he or she is freed. Where water, earth, fire, and wind have no footing. Earth, water, earth, fire, and wind, it can be understood in Buddhist language as kind of a shorthand for our experience of the world. Our experience of the tangible world is through these three categories. And where they have no footing. It's kind of a strange expression, perhaps. But it's a, remember, this is a time and a place very distant from English. And in English, we have words that are similar to this, or concepts that are similar. And we talk about getting caught up, hung up, We talk about having hooks or buttons or being pushed around. So there's all kinds of ways in which our experience of life, our thoughts, our feelings, events that happen around us, that they push our buttons, or we get hung up, or get caught by them, or we get somehow stopped by them, or we resist them, or we grab onto them. So in the ancient language, they say that the world has a foothold. It has a place where, in your mind, where it could stop and rest and stand. And some of you probably have had the experience here of seeing the difference between putting up something, some resistance or some hooks. Something happens and you get hooked by it. And in a different time, the same thing might happen, similar thing might happen, and there's no hooks for it, and just kind of passes right through, or just doesn't get stuck anywhere in your mind. Sometimes on a retreat, people will Vipassana Vendetta about someone who's really noisy in the hall near them. The Velcro jacket phenomena. That seems to go on and off in the course of the sitting. And so it's not uncommon for someone to come to a teacher and say, you have to do something about that person. And it's not uncommon for the teachers to say, well, I think you should practice with it. And it's not uncommon for the person to come back some days later and say, oh, I realized that actually this something like, I thought the sound was bothering me, but really I was bothering the sound. The sound met something inside of me. It met my indignation, it met my attachment to my practice and my peace. The hook or the button was my judgments about how people should be on retreat. There's all these hooks, all these ledges, all these footholds in the mind where that sound can settle. But if there's no foothold, if there's no hooks, no buttons, then it's just a sound going through. It's not a problem. And this is a very important principle in Dharma practice, at least, the principle of taking responsibility for our suffering, for our hooks and our buttons and what goes on, and not looking outside and saying, that's the problem. And it's a very challenging teaching, and something that takes maybe years to really grasp the real implications of it. But there, to find that place in the mind, find that capacity of freedom, of release, where there is no foothold. And in that place, there the stars do not shine, the sun is not visible, the moon does not appear. That sounds a little bit gloomy. And so it's a little bit like, what's going on here? But then it says, and darkness is not found. So now we're talking about something different. This is not something that's ordinary. Some place where there's neither light nor darkness. What is that place? Is there such a place? A place where there's no hooks. No place where the mind doesn't get caught. A place where the mind is free. Is it something about that place being a place where there's neither light nor darkness? It's not gloomy because it's not dark. And I think that some of you might have had experiences that maybe somewhat similar to this and give you a little sense of it. If you've ever had the experience of being, if you're really feeling somehow in a palpable way or immediate way, the timelessness of the present moment. Sometimes, you've done some great maybe hike in the wilderness, and maybe not, you've gone someplace and taken a nice nap under an apple tree, or maybe in lovemaking, or maybe in, there's all kinds of different kinds of situations. Maybe you wake up in the middle of the night sometimes, and something very palpable and beautiful at times about the timelessness of the present moment. It seems to extend forever, it's very spacious, very broad. It's almost as if time has stopped. Often comes with a sense of peacefulness. And where is it? You can't point to it. It doesn't have a color, it doesn't have a shape, it doesn't have a smell, it doesn't have a location. So all the usual reference points for understanding, it's not quite there. But it's still, it's more, sometimes more real than anything real. Just a very, very strong feeling at times. It doesn't matter if it's dark or if it's light. You can have a timeless presence laying in your bed in the dark, and you can have it in full sunlight. But somehow that place of the timeless presence is not, in some ways, touched by light or darkness. It has no monetary value. So maybe it's not interesting. Why bother? Can't get it for Christmas. Not something you can wear as a badge. Increase your status at work. And when many times the mind is interested in things that can do something for us, that's tangible and immediate and something clear, like, you know, more money or a better house or a better relationship or better status or more comfort or, you know, something. But the timeless present, which can be quite satisfying, is not a thing like that. It's kind of ephemeral. It's kind of like you can't grab it, kind of, you know. But it's something. So the place where earth, water, fire, and air doesn't have a footing is kind of like that. It's a definitely a kind of dimension, a possibility, a dimension of the mind that's very different than how the mind normally relates to life and reality and to ourselves. So it's kind of pointing towards a mind which is free. And when a sage, through wisdom, knows this for him or herself, then from form and formless, from bliss and pain, he or she is freed. Some people get attached to the world of form, of things, and some people get attached to the world of formlessness, that's not of things. For example, the timeless present, maybe, get attached to that, the formless world. And this is actually something which is freed from both the formless and the form. It's freedom from both bliss and pain. Now, why in the world would you want to not be, you know, why do you want to be freed from bliss? I mean, you know, it's been bad enough all along. And freedom from bliss, and that seems kind of boring. I mean, it was these Buddhists are so flat, you know. Norwegian Buddhists. You know. Watch out for them. The Buddha wasn't Norwegian. I'm sure it was a different flavor. But each to his own flavor. And but the freedom from bliss and freedom from pain is freedom, and freedom is delicious. Freedom is the best. So that was the inspired words, and now the story that led up to it, that inspired that. And maybe by the time we get to the story, you also understand this poem a little better. It starts off in India, time of the Buddha, at the seaside near the ocean. And there was a renunciant by the name of Bahia of the bark cloth. Apparently he only wore clothes made of bark. They pound bark to become soft and make it into kind of cloth. And the text says that this man was worshipped, revered, honored, venerated, given homage, given a lot of respect. And I think his story has helped if you give him the benefit of the doubt that all this reverence that he received was because he deserved it. That he was a mature person, a spiritually mature person. He was a spiritual practitioner, and he was mature. And then the question I ask you, and a question I don't want to answer tonight, but rather something maybe you'll live with for a while, is what does it mean to be spiritually mature? What does it mean to be humanly mature? And you might ponder that after the retreat, and you might talk to your friends and see what they think. And you might go find the most mature persons around and ask them, what does it mean to be mature? Humanly mature, spiritually mature, what does that mean? So this man was a mature person. Now, some of the things it can mean, among other things, is that he was a really honest man. The level of integrity, sincerity, of honesty. I don't think you can have maturity without honesty. Certainly, you know, without self-honesty. And you'll see in a few minutes that he was an honest person. Sincere. It probably means that maturity probably means that there's a certain kind of healthy perspective about life and experiences of life. What's important and what's not important. My guess is he did not spend a lot of time watching television. I think he probably had better things to do, or the equivalent back then. Sometimes we say that, or there's a kind of assumption that as people get older, meaning elders, you know, that they become wise. And for a long time, I thought that was because they had a lot of life experience. And in the last years, I've been thinking, well, maybe that's some of it. But also I think that as at a certain age, your death is close by, you know, it's almost visible. You get a sense, now it's, you know, you don't have unlimited time to do whatever you want anymore. You know, you kind of get a sense, you know, it's coming. And for some people, that happens when they turn 50, some when they're 60, I don't know, different people, different, they get a sense. And that proximity to death creates a different perspective of what's important. And that perspective of what's important, I think it brings a certain kind of maturity of what is important. When I was 14, what was really important was going to school without zits. I was afraid people were going to laugh. and now, I think I have one. You know, and I really don't care what you think. It's even, not only do I, you know, just, even if you did laugh at me, I don't care. So you get a different perspective as you get older. So certain things when you were in your 20s, those of you who've already been through your 20s, you look back and say, what was I thinking? Or, you know, certain kind of a phenomenal attachment with job and work and advancement in work and get to retirement and say, what was I thinking? So a lot of things shift. One woman I know, when she was in her mid-60s, she said, I finally realized by learning to kind of see through a lot of the cultural things I'd learned and growing up, I don't need a man. That's something. I don't need to be in a certain kind of relationship. So there's a kind of maturing that happens, a certain perspective that changes what's important. I think that a part of maturity is not being caught up in what other people think of you, or caught up in trying to create an image so we present ourselves a certain way so we kind of control the image of how people see us. A big learning for me was to overcome my attachment, my addiction, my neurosis of wanting to be liked. That was I had a lot of suffering around that. So that was a hook, that was a foothold for life experience, wanting to be liked. Boy, was that ever a foothold. Big hook, big button. Someone who's mature has learned to let go. Probably has let go of things which are not worth holding on to. And then I would propose there's a lot of things people in this world hold on to that are not really worth it. If you did a cost-benefit analysis, doesn't come out in favor of holding on. It's not uncommon for people, when they start doing mindfulness practice, and they start investigating their anger rather than kind of just believing it and acting on it, but stop and look at it carefully, and they, my God, I didn't know it hurt so much. I'm hurting myself more than the person I'm angry with. It's not worth it. And so it's easier to let go when you realize how much you're hurting yourself, even though that person's justified in blaming. So you learn to let go. And so Bahia was a man who had learned to let go. He had that ability. And he'd probably let go of a lot because he was renunciant, living this way. He was a recipient of robes, alms food, lodgings, and medical requisites for the sick. This is the only things, the only possessions that he had. He had, just like a Buddhist monk would have, just a few simple robes, maybe the only ones he wore, and alms food. He had probably a bowl, just lived on his alms food that he got each day, didn't have a refrigerator. Simple lodgings, and in the ancient world, renunciant was allowed to have medicine, sort of kind of simple medicine. So he learned to let go of a lot. And again, giving him the benefit of the doubt, he probably learned to do that in the healthiest possible ways. Let go of the appropriate things, and had learned how to do that in a good way. He was mature, learned to let go. And then he asked himself, he was alone one day, and he asked himself this question. I think it speaks really well for him that he asked this question. Now, of those who in this world who are enlightened or have entered the path to enlightenment, am I one? He'd been practicing spirituality for a long time. He was respected. He probably had a certain degree of maturity and maybe even some kind of attainment. And he said, am I really enlightened? Rather than assuming he was, because he got all this reverence from people. And then there was a kind of a minor god that somehow overheard him thinking this thought. And this minor god came to do him a favor. And then God said, you, Bahia, are neither enlightened, nor have you entered the path to enlightenment. You don't even have the practice whereby you would become enlightened or enter the path of enlightenment. That's pretty good. You know, what have I been doing all these years? You know, just, you know, boom. It's good to have teachers like that. And then, to his credit, he doesn't get defensive or apologetic or to explain himself. One of the signs of being mature is not being so defensive or apologetic. Imagine living a life that's unapologetic. You don't have to apologize for being alive. Wouldn't that be good? Then he asks, but who in this world is enlightened or has entered the path of enlightenment? Then God says, Bahia, there is a city in the northern country called Savatthi. The Buddha, an enlightened person, rightly self-awakened, is living there now. He is truly enlightened, and he teaches the Dharma that leads to enlightenment. Then Bahia, deeply chastened by the God, left where he was right then and there. Didn't even bother to go get his, you know, go say goodbye even. He just right then and there, headed for Savatthi. In the space of one day and one night, went all the way to where the Blessed One was staying near Savatthi, in Jetta's Grove. So it's a long distance from the ocean to Savatthi, to Sarvasti Varanasi. So probably he didn't do it in a day. But I take the story day and night, but I take the story to mean that he was really resolved, really intent. And that's also a sign of maturity, to have the ability, appropriately, to have great resolve, determination. This is what I'm doing. This is important. Get out of my way. You know, I'm not going to let anything else interfere. And so he probably did, you know, set out and just without any hesitation. That's what he did, just headed for Savatthi to see the Buddha. Day and night he walked, maybe no drinking, no eating, just that's what he was going to do. And he came to Jetta's Grove where the Buddha was residing. And he came across some monks who were doing walking meditation. And he went up to them and said, "Where's the Buddha?" And they said, "Oh, he's gone into towns for his alms to gather his food for the day." Then Bahiya, hurriedly leaving Jetta's Grove and entering Savatthi, saw the Buddha going for alms. Calm, calming, his senses at peace, his mind at peace, tranquil and poised in the ultimate sense, accomplished, trained, guarded, a great one. Actually, the word is in Pali is naga, great snake. But I like this expression, calm and calming. He was both calm and his presence was calming. So he rushed off to meet this man who's calm, intent to get some teaching, to meet this man. And he says to the Buddha, "Teach me the Dharma. Teach me the Dharma, O well-gone one, that will be for my long-term welfare and bliss." And the Buddha says to him, "This is not the time, Bahiya. We have entered town for alms. It's the wrong time. Yeah. You don't call someone while having dinner." And so Bahiya asks again. He doesn't take no for an answer. And the Buddha says again, "It's not the time, please." But Bahiya, you know, he's intent, right? When I was in Japan, I was a Zen monk in Japan. And after a while, I kind of lost my Zen teacher. And so I was traveling around Japan looking for a teacher, and there's a whole culture and custom about how you look for a teacher if you're a Zen monk in Japan. And I was going to go see this great Zen master, and I was being coached how to do that. You know, how to go see this great guy, because it's kind of difficult to see anyone. And I was told, "Oh, because you're, you know, looking for a teacher, you go unannounced. You just go show up. That's the cult. That's what you do. You just show up." And I think partly it expresses that sincerity and that dedication that, you know, this is what you do. So I did, and he wasn't home. And then a third time, Bahiya asked, and he said it this way, "But it is hard to know for sure what dangers there may be for the Blessed One's life, or what dangers there may be for mine. Teach me the Dharma. Teach me the Dharma, O well-gone one, that will be for my long-term welfare and bliss." You never know when you're going to die. I've known people who said, "Later. I'll get to spiritual practice later. You know, just finish this work, do this thing, raise my kids, do whatever, and later, I'll get to it. There are important things to do, later." Will there be a later? You don't know. I've known people who've regretted waiting. So there's something also about the spiritual life that for some people, it's so centrally important to their life that it doesn't make sense to wait. You never know how much time you have. And Bahiya is one man like this. It's, "Please, tell me now. I don't know how long we have." So there's a custom in ancient world that if you ask a Buddha something three times, he's obligated to answer. So the Buddha answered then. And this is that teaching that's quoted very frequently here at Spirit Rock. And it's kind of like a, expresses something essential about mindfulness practice. I'll read it and explain it. And what the Buddha is doing here is, in a nutshell, in a very kind of, very powerful, very kind of brief and succinct way, pointing to liberation, pointing to the path to liberation. Then, Bahiya, you should train yourself thus. In the seen, let there only be the seen. In the heard, let there only be the heard. In the sensed, let there only be the sensed. And in the cognized, let there only be the cognized. This is the first part. So in the seen, what you see, the seen, let there be just the seen, and the heard, just the heard, the sensed, just the sensed, the cognized, just the cognized. Now it's interesting to study how easy it is to add things on to what is seen, or heard, or sensed, or cognized. More often than not, we're always in relationship to this world of ours that we experience. A lot of that time has to do with how it relates to me. To my comfort, to my safety, to my desires, to my opinions. So I could sit here and see this bell. And I can see a bell, and I can just, in the seeing, just a seeing, and the bell, seeing a bell, just a bell. And then I can add layers and layers of overlay on that bed, that's this bell. I can see it as, oh, this is the bed, the bell they have at Spirit Rock. It's a pretty innocent overlay, but still it's an overlay. It's a bell that was given to Spirit Rock by San Francisco Zen Center. Isn't that nice? So I can add another overlay. It's a bell that really sounds good when you meditate. I need to have that bell. If I had that bell in my house, my meditations would be profound. I wonder who I talk to. I want that bell. Or an overlay could be, what in the world are they doing with such a big, expensive bell? These people here. Who are these people here? And how could they have done that? And I should talk to someone. So there's overlays. It isn't just a scene in the scene. It's a scene, and then there's all these reactions, responses, opinions that get overlaid into it. Someone comes into the meditation hall late. In the heard, just the heard. Or, in the heard, doesn't that know that the period's started 10 minutes ago? How could someone come in late? Those teachers, they really should set that strict discipline. If this was a Zen center, they wouldn't allow it. And these Vipassana people, they're so wishy-washy. You know, and they really need to get these people, they really should get serious about their practice and really meditate well, and then they know that they have real discipline, and probably those teachers don't even know how to be present. And, oh, wait a minute, what am I doing? You know, you spend half an hour kind of going off, right? And it's an overlay, right? And the herd, just the herd, but no, it's all the stuff that goes on. Added to it. Some of it has to do with what's out there, judgments and opinions, and some of it has, the overlay has to do with how we are in experiencing it. So I hear the bell, and I might have thought, I don't think I heard it right. I don't think I must have missed something important. Or let me give you a better example. When I was a new practitioner, GIL was short for guilt. And I'd feel, opening a door is just opening a door, right? But I'd feel guilty. I was opening the door in the wrong way. I'd walk across the meditation hall floor, and I was doing it the wrong way. A friend of mine who died got all these books. He was dying. He got all these books on death and dying. He was afraid he was going to fail at dying. I don't know anybody who's failed. I mean, the dead people haven't. But he thought he would do it the wrong way. So some of this overlay has to do with subjective ideas of who we are, who we think we're supposed to be. Sitting, watching the breath, meditation. When I was in Thailand, I had a lot of constipation and really bloated feelings. And, it was just, when you're bloated, you're bloated. In the bloated, just the bloatedness. But I added so much on top of it. Or sleepiness, the amount of suffering I had around being sleepy, until I learned that in sleepiness, just be sleepy. Be aware of sleepiness. And it wasn't a personal failing that I took it to be. I can tell you horror stories. So this, in the seeing, just a seeing, is a very profound thing, especially when you realize the alternative for most of us most of the time is a complicated world of abstractions and emotional reactivity, a lot of buttons pushed. And it's a great relief and also a release to just leave things be really simple, leave them alone. And that's what we're asked to do in mindfulness practice, is to learn to leave things alone, our experience. Just have the experience be what it is, and learn to distinguish the interpretation, the reaction, from the experience itself. It's not an easy thing to do, because often our interpretation, our opinions, our views, our emotional responses are so entangled with the experience that we don't see them as being separate. It's like canned laughter on television. The joke's not really funny, but because the canned laughter is there, it seems kind of funny. We kind of get caught by it, it's contagious. But if you separate, if you turn off the sound, I guess, the canned laughter, you kind of see, or the mood music. You don't separate the scene in the woods without the mood music. They can have wonderful romantic music and you get, it means something. Or some this ominous music and uh-oh. Just a scene in the woods, right? So the mood is entangled with what's there. So part of mindfulness practice is beginning to tease apart what's extra. And then to have the wisdom about, is that extra necessary or not? Is it useful? Some of it is. And some of it is just not useful at all. It's well worth letting go of, being healed from. So a lot of the mindfulness practice is not necessarily being able to, in the seeing, just a seeing, heard, just a heard. But rather, a lot of mindfulness practice is learning to see, I'm entangled. I'm judging. I'm caught in my opinions, my self-consciousness. Then, in the self-consciousness, can it just be self-consciousness? In the opinion, can just be the opinion. As opposed to, oh, I have an opinion. I'm a bad meditator now. We just add more and more complications. So the kind of direction the mindfulness practice is going is becoming simple. To grant, it's a kind of act of generosity to let each experience, to grant each experience, to give each experience we have its pristine simplicity of what it is in itself. It's a great thing to give to a friend, to let your friend be who they are, to let Howie be his suchness. Each of us, to see ourselves in our suchness. So then the Buddha went on. When for you there will be only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized. When you have a thought, just let it be a thought. Then, Bahia, there is no you in connection with that. There is no you in connection with that. there's a bell, and there's no me in connection to the bell. Just a bell. My identity is not tied to being a really good teacher who knows just right how to hit the bell. Then there's a me in connection to the bell. The best bell hitter at Spirit Rock. It's just a bell. Just hitting the bell. There's no me in the bell. No me implied or invested or made up in relationship to it. There's no me there. This is a very profound thing, not to find a me. And the bell is kind of a simple kind of example. But what about in your pain, physical pain? Some people find there's a big difference in their mind to experience that there's a difference between experiencing pain as my pain versus the pain. And that when you say my pain, there's an overlay, there's a little extra kind of thing that's added to it. There's a foothold, there's a button. And it's a magnet for all kinds of things. My pain, my pain. And you might experiment a little bit, just saying those things in your mind, in your mind. And you might find when you say the pain, maybe it's just infinitesimal, but you might feel a little bit more kind of, more space, or a little bit more freedom from it. So in the scene, just the scene, there won't be any you to be found there. Is that okay? Is it okay not to find a you in the bell? Is it okay not to find a you in the pain? Is it okay not to find a you in feeling sadness or happiness? And the sadness just a sadness, and the happiness just a happiness. Many emotions we have, there's layers and layers of hooks and buttons and opinions and footholds that has meaning we assign to it. Can it do the pristine simplicity of an emotion? Just that by itself. So, no you there. And if there's no you in connection to that experience, when there's no you there, you are neither here nor there or in between. You don't find yourself in that experience. You are not found here or there or in between. There's no location for you if you're not using something to reference yourself. You stop existing because you're not there this way? Not at all. But there's lack of that self-consciousness, which is one of the footholds where our life experience settles and gets caught. And it's one of the great offerings of Buddhist practice is an experience of freedom. Where we shed all the unnecessary movements of being self-conscious. Self-conscious in the sense of being self-preoccupied. Defining our experience with reference to me here. So to be alive, unapologetic, to be alive and be undefended because there's nothing to defend. No idea, no image. To be alive and have nothing you need to prove. In the seen, just a seen. In the cognized, just a cognized. In the feelings, just the feelings. In the motivations, just the motivation. And the action is just the action. There's something very simple, radically simple, about this place of freedom. And the Buddha went on to say, this, just this, is the end of stress, of suffering. Just this is the end of suffering. And that's kind of the primary context for all this teaching. And it said over and over again in the sutta, it was really out of compassion the Buddha taught this. He was really concerned with our suffering, that human beings suffer. And he's offering is pointing to a dimension, a way of being alive, which doesn't diminish us. The shedding of the attachment, shedding of this self-consciousness, of self-image, of self-identity, is not a diminishment. If anything, it's an enhancement. In a sense, we get so big that it doesn't make any sense to say us anymore, me, I. There's no location, no here or there or in between. When you're peaceful and quiet, is there a location for your awareness? Is your awareness bounded? Is it just inside your skull? The sense of consciousness or awareness, does it have a limit? Does it have an outer boundary, how far it goes? It does if you define your consciousness by your thinking. Then it can feel much more like it's claustrophobic. But if you can learn to step outside of thinking, or sense or feel yourself, feel your way beyond thinking, in the space between your thoughts, there's a vast world. Who are you when you're not telling yourself who you are? So the Buddha is pointing to a place of freedom. In the seeing, just the seeing, in the heard, just the heard, in the sense, just the sensed, in the cognized, just the cognized. Through hearing this brief explanation of the Dharma, the mind of Bahiya, right then and there, was released. Right then and there was freed. He was ready. He was mature, right? He wasn't holding on to much. Maybe he let go of almost everything that was worth letting go of, except some kind of, even a lot of his conceit, self-image issues and all kinds of things. But maybe there was still a very subtle sense of I am. I'm the one who's doing this. I'm the one who's practicing. I'm the one who's going to become free. And this teaching of this transparent place, and the seeing just a seeing, it freed him from that last place where he's still, even the sense of I am-ness. And then the story goes on a little bit more, maybe as a way of emphasizing the uncertainty of life and death. Because it's said that when Bahiya left, just a little bit later, he got gored by a cow and died. You never know. He was right, he didn't know. It was really important to get that teaching then and there. And so then when the monks came and found the Buddha and explained to him what had happened to Bahiya, had died, then the Buddha composed this poem. Remembering Bahiya, remembering just the remembering, remembered Bahiya that he met earlier in the day, reflected on him, understood that the Buddha understood that his mind was liberated, he was a liberated person. And though perhaps it was sad that he died, it was a great event that he touched freedom before he died. He experienced full freedom. And it's in this regard, on this occasion, that the Buddha expressed this inspired saying, where water, earth, fire, and wind have no footing, there the stars do not shine, the sun is not visible. The moon does not appear. Darkness is not found. When a sage, through wisdom, knows this for him or herself, then from form and formless, from bliss and pain, he or she is freed. This is pointing to a possibility which would be quite foreign idea to most people living kind of the ordinary life of greed, hate and desire, of self preoccupation and consumerism and all this stuff, where the mind is kept on a treadmill and busyness, and where the life is so much about things, about relationships to our me, to the world, to other people, and to the future and the past. And when the mind and world is caught up in the world of things and relationships and thoughts and ideas, it's like there's, you can't imagine. You can't even imagine. The stillness which is here in this room right now. And perhaps the sweetness of the stillness. Can't imagine that it's another dimension, another possibility, but so radical and so simple at the same time. In the seen, just the seen. In the heard, just the heard. In the sensed, just the sensed. In the cognized, just the cognized. In the thoughts you're having right now, just the thoughts. In the feelings you're having right now, just the feelings. Giving yourself the time to discover the pristine simplicity of now.